This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, conversation with Anthony Swinger, who is with the Indiana Office of Utility Consumer Counselor. Coming up on January 3rd, the Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission will hold a field hearing in Merrillville about NIPSCO's request for an increase in their basic natural gas rates. We'll find out more about that and about the procedure that the IURC has set up to consider these cases. Also, Lake County Surveyor Bill Emerson joins us to talk about the next two public meetings to be held in Lowell and in Calumet Township about that comprehensive land use plan for unincorporated sections of Lake County. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission is going to hold a field hearing for NIPSCO's request to raise natural gas rates. It's coming up very soon. Put it on the calendar. To find out more about the upcoming hearing, we have Anthony Swinger, who is with the Office of the Indiana Utility Consumer Counselor in Indianapolis. They are ones that keep track of these and are beneficiaries of the information from the state utility regulators as a representative of the consumer, you. And we have Anthony with us to talk about this upcoming field hearing. Anthony, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having us on.
Well, for first off here, give us an idea, remind us again what NIPSCO is asking for in this particular case and what this field hearing is going to be all about.
Sure. In this particular case, NIPSCO is seeking an increase in its natural gas base rates. Electric rates would not be affected in this case. This is focusing strictly on natural gas. NIPSCO has made the request to the Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission, and the way these cases work, it's very similar to a civil court case. The biggest difference is the parties put all their direct testimony in writing, just because of the highly technical nature of what we're dealing with. So in any given case, the Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission is required by law to balance ratepayer interests with utility interests, look at all the evidence that's in the record in the case before it, and then make a decision. If a utility seeks a rate increase, it will be represented in the case by attorneys and expert witnesses. As far as providing the attorneys and expert witnesses for the customers, that's where we come in. The Office of Utility Consumer Counselor is a separate state agency. We participate in all cases before the IURC, and our job is to represent the interests of all consumers, residential, commercial, and industrial. In this particular case, NIPSCO made its request several weeks ago. It filed a few thousand pages of testimony, exhibits, and accounting work papers. Our staff at the OUCC is in the process of reviewing all of those documents now, and the Commission's given us until January 24th to complete our review and file testimony spelling out the position that we will have taken at that point.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand that the IURC, the utility regulators, have set up a field hearing, as they call it, for the public to have a chance to find out more, I guess, at that hearing and have a chance, I guess, to put in some of their two cents worth in if they wish to. And then, of course, they can always submit it in writing later. Tell us about when this scheduled field hearing is going to be held and where it's going to be held.
Sure. There are actually going to be three public field hearings in the case. The first is tonight in Fort Wayne, but the next field hearing is scheduled in Merrillville. It will be at Merrillville High School in the Freshman Lecture Hall, and it's scheduled for January 3rd. So just after the first of the year, January 3rd, 2018, will be the public field hearing in the NIPSCO case. Again, it'll be in the Freshman Lecture Hall at Merrillville High School, and it will start at 6 o'clock local time. The public field hearing is an opportunity for consumers to speak directly to the commission for the record and under oath, and any comments that are provided by consumers under oath become evidence in the case that the commission's required to review before it makes a decision. Now, if a consumer cannot be at the hearing and wants to provide written comments, he or she is more than welcome to send those our way. We need to receive all written comments in this case by January 17th. That will give us time to review them and get them filed with the commission for the case's record. There's a third field hearing that will be scheduled in South Bend. It will come up later. That hasn't been scheduled yet, but again, the Lake County hearing will be on January 3rd at Merrillville High School at 6 o'clock local time.
I guess the nice thing about these is that even though that they seem to be very, very officious type meetings, the idea is that regardless of whether you speak at the hearing or whether you turn something in writing, it's just as important. It's all taken very seriously, and it'll all, as you say, it'll become evidence in the record once it puts together, I would imagine.
Absolutely. Our staff at the OUCC conducts a legal and technical review of any particular case that goes before the commission. We have a team right now of lawyers, accountants, economists, and engineers that is looking over NIPSCO's request very closely. We're doing a very thorough analysis. But, of course, input from the customer is very important as well. And that's why we want to encourage folks to either attend the hearing or send written comments to us that we can include in the record.
From what you can tell, when was the last time that the Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission had granted any kind of increase in NIPSCO's base gas rates?
The last base gas rate increase was in 1988. Much more recently, there was another rate case for NIPSCO's gas utility. It resulted in an overall decrease in the base rate revenues. It's important to keep in mind, though, that bills have changed since then for a couple of reasons. One is the TDSIC tracker, which, to put it as simply as possible, is a mechanism that lets the utility seek incremental increases when they conduct, complete specific infrastructure projects.
Right.
Those increases have been ongoing with NIPSCO and with several other utilities around the state. And then another big driver in the gas bill is the gas cost, the actual wholesale commodity cost. NIPSCO and other gas utilities around the state are allowed to pass those costs through to customers on a dollar-for-dollar basis. They can't profit on those pass-throughs. They have to show that they're shopping prudently in the wholesale market. So those costs are reviewed every 3 months. The OUCC reviews them, and the IURC has to take final action on any changes to the rates. And those can go up or down over time, depending on what happens with the wholesale market. The gas cost adjustment for NIPSCO for a residential bill is roughly half of the bill during the winter. The other half, we're talking about the base rate, and that deals with operating costs, maintenance costs, infrastructure projects, security, basically everything but the gas itself, everything to keep the transmission and distribution system running. That's what's at issue in the rate case that's pending now. And as I said, NIPSCO filed this request earlier this year. We are right now in the part of the case where the OUCC is doing its review and where we're inviting public comments. And then we would expect a commission decision to come probably during the summer of 2018.
And so it looks like that even if they get even a portion of what they have requested as far as the basic rates concerned, we're not likely to see it on our NIPSCO utility bills, the natural gas portion of the bill, probably until sometime in the fall, I would imagine.
It's important to keep in mind that whenever a utility files a rate case, the commission's given 300 days to conduct the process. That includes time for the utility to file testimony, the OUCC to complete our review and file our testimony. The utility gets a chance at rebuttal. There are other parties that intervene in the case. They can file testimony as well, and there are hearings. So it's a quite detailed process. There are a number of steps in it, but if you do the math from when NIPSCO initiated this case, we're looking at an order from the commission most likely in July. Once that order comes out, the utility typically has 30 days to submit a new tariff. If that tariff's approved, then the rates kick in.
All right. So it's late summer at the very earliest, and maybe into the fall months, I guess, before we start to see something here on our bills at home, I guess.
That's correct. And keep in mind, again, that this case is dealing only with natural gas.
Yeah.
The electric utility's not at issue in this particular case.
Well, they've already been before the IURC for some changes that have been approved here because they've been going through their own modernization process and trying to upgrade the electrical distribution system. And they're continuing to do that as well, too. So this is just kind of following up on the natural gas side of it as well, too. It's interesting this should come up at this time, Anthony Swinger, because we know that NIPSCO has gone through some internal changes as well. They've picked on picked up some new business, and they've passed off some new business as well. They had Columbia Gas as part of their subsidiaries, and they've passed that off now. So they've kind of specified that they've kind of made some changes to their business model. They're trying to pare things down, I suppose.
And it's important to keep in mind that whenever we have a rate case before the Regulatory Commission, we're focusing specifically on the regulated utility. And as you mentioned, there are a number of entities under the NiSource umbrella, the NIPSCO gas utility, of course, being one of those. Right. And so that's really where we're focused in this case. And that's where the utility has the burden of proof to show, number one, that it needs more revenue, and number two, the amount of revenue that it needs.
Well, it sounds like a lot more work is still ahead, certainly for you folks at the Office of Utility Consumer Counselor, as well as the Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission, as they start to get things together for their final decision coming up here into 2018 on this request from NIPSCO for the increase in natural gas rates. We're talking with Anthony Swinger, who is a spokesperson for the OUCC in Indianapolis. And as always, thank you very much for being with us, Anthony, to talk about this.
My pleasure.
And he also remembers that if you want to submit a written comment on NIPSCO's basic natural gas rate increase request, you can go to their website, which is www.in.gov/OUCC. That's the homepage to the OUCC, and click on the Contact Us button on the homepage, and it'll take you to an electronic form that you can type on. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Series of public meetings coming up this week to talk about Lake County's comprehensive master plan for the land use areas outside of the towns and the city limits. And we're turning once again to County Surveyor Bill Emerson to talk about it. Bill, thanks for being with us on Regionally Speaking today.
Oh, thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Well, remind people what this plan is all about that the ARSH group is working with you folks there in Lake County government.
Right now we're working on kind of an update of our kind of very old comprehensive plan for the unincorporated areas of Lake County. So that's basically a lot of the south half of Lake County and also Cal Township there in the north part of the county. What we're doing is looking at kind of land use issues, zoning, parks, recreation, things like that, in a way that we can kind of have a framework and a plan moving forward on how these areas get developed or don't get developed, depending on what the areas want to do. So we're reaching out to the public, asking them to come on out tomorrow night, December 12th, at Lowell Middle School, and that's at 19250 Klein Avenue in Lowell. At 6 p.m., and then December 13th at Calumet High School at 6 p.m.
Which, by the way, for people that aren't familiar with that necessarily, that neighborhood, that's just south of Ridge Road, actually. It's Ridge Road and Calhoun Street, which puts it right there, just basically outside the town limits of Griffith, I guess.
That's right, yes. Yeah.
With all of this information that has come in so far, what kinds of comments or questions have you had in some of the previous similar meetings that you've had elsewhere in the county?
Yeah, so it's been a good turnout so far, and a lot of good comments coming in. And also, if you can't make the meeting, you can go to lakecountyplan.org, and you can provide your comments there too. There's very, very comments. I mean, a lot of people have a lot of different interests and concerns. A lot of folks are, especially down in the south part of county, want to make sure that they kind of retain the rural kind of ways about the south county. Issues, a lot of folks would like to see, more parks, more recreational trails, things like that. And there are ways we can sort of encourage that and look for areas to do that based on how we set up our zoning and kind of our plan moving forward.
When you talk about South Lake County, we know that's the area where we've seen the most growth in not only residences, but even some industrial and commercial development down that way, too.
That's right. That's right. And it's important that as a county plan commission that we kind of take a look at it and take it kind of an inventory and have public meetings at how we look at how we want that to develop and where those developments should happen.
Now, I know that you're involved as the Lake County Surveyor because a lot of the times you may get called out with your crews in your office to be able to deal with some of the requests concerning land use and the like. But also, too, you're a key member of the Plan Commission, which is going to be able to take a look at this plan and actually get to work with it, whatever comes out of it, right?
That's right. That's right. So it's important to have to kind of have that framework when the Plan Commission's making those decisions moving forward on whether, you know, a development should go in somewhere or where it shouldn't. And also one of the things that we've heard a lot from folks is, you know, they're, you know, we know the development's coming. There's especially on the kind of on the west side of the county there, a lot of folks coming in from Illinois. And we want to make sure that those developments happen in a kind of a way that makes sense and closer to kind of the current municipal areas so that you know, utilities and things can be utilized being close to those areas.
Now, I know that your office doesn't necessarily deal with this, although a lot of times you do get these requests that come in, dealing with drainage matters and the like. And a lot of times land use and drainage kind of go hand to hand, don't they?
Well, that's right. That's absolutely right. And so we see a lot of areas that do see some flooding problems, and we try to handle those and manage those the best we can. And we actually have a separate drainage ordinance through our kind of through our drainage board and through mm-hmm. my office that is pretty strict on issues on drainage issues. We take a really hard look at new developments to make sure that they're not impacting, you know, their neighbors as far as, you know, increased water runoff or anything like that.
Are we finding over the recent years, and I'm sure this probably was one reason that prompted for bringing up reworking this comprehensive land use plan, was you've got areas of Lake County which are immediately outside of the towns and cities, and what comes to mind are places even outside the city of Gary or outside the city of Griffith in the north part of the county, and then points to the south where the development is growing so quickly that it's probably people, the ones that live in those neighborhoods probably feel like they're being squeezed out.
Well, I think that's true. I think there's a group of people who do feel that way. So mm-hmm. part of this process is to say, hey, wait a minute, you know, do we want to have some of this land here targeted for agricultural use and to make sure that it maintains that character, and also, you know, make sure that, you know, we're working with the different municipalities to make sure that, you know, what we're doing kind of jives with their potential targeted areas and things like that.
Now, Bill Emerson, give us an idea, once you get all the comments in, how many more of public sessions like the ones coming up this week, Tuesday and Wednesday, are going to happen? And then once all the scheduled public meetings are going to take place, so how are you going to get all this information together and be able to get this put together into this comprehensive land use plan?
Sure. So after the two meetings that we're having this week, we're going to have one more in February where we're going to get hopefully kind of closer to our final draft of mm-hmm. our plan, and then a final meeting in March, and that's all, I guess, dependent on how things go. I mean, it's a pretty rigid process. We're trying to get everything done on time, but, you know, as things pop up, you know, we want to make sure we're taking a hard look at everything and really reviewing everything. So we're shooting for March to have our final draft plan together to present at a meeting in March.
Mm-hmm. Now, who gets to make the final vote on this?
Well, the Plan Commission itself does vote on the plan, and then it goes to the county council.
So actually, you've got two governmental agencies that are going to be looking it over here, and then the council will sign off on it as well, too. I'm sure they probably do in some respects because they have to deal with budgets and the like, too, I would imagine.
Right, uh-huh. Right.
Okay. Now, when do you hope that if things go well and then the timetables follow through and all the agencies sign off on it appropriately, when do you hope to have this comprehensive land use plan ready for use so that in your office and your staff members, when you get your question and the questions asked, you can have them say, well, let's look at the new plan and see what it has to say?
Yeah, so hopefully shortly, you know, in the first half of next year, we should have the final plan done, hopefully.
Will anybody see any real major changes that you can tell right now in how things are handled, how land use is allocated? And I know this is probably for planning purposes way into the future, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, nothing, not immediately. It's going to be, again, this is more of a kind of a vision for the future and how we handle requests moving forward for different developments. So it's more of a, you know, just kind of a template and a way that we can kind of move things to the future.
Bill Emerson, thank you very much for talking about this today and hope that you get more good comments at the two meetings scheduled this week.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Bill Emerson is Lake County Surveyor, and he's been telling us about the Lake County Plan Commission's work on a new comprehensive land use plan for some of the unincorporated areas outside of the cities and the town limits. Another series of public meetings coming up. The first is going to be Tuesday tomorrow at the Lowell Middle School cafeteria down in West Creek Township. And then the next meeting after that is going to be the following day on Wednesday, the 13th. It'll be held in the Commons area at Calumet New Tech High School, which is on Calhoun Street, just south of Ridge Road in Calumet Township. Affordable housing and neighborhood blight are ongoing problems around Indianapolis. A small nonprofit has spent years trying to solve both at once in a near east side neighborhood called St. Clair Place. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Drew Dodlin reports on the group's approach and starts the story with resident Andy Austin, who is describing the moment that he first saw his home 6 years ago following behind a realtor.
So he pulled out his screwdriver and took the plywood off the door, and we came in, and it was pretty grim.
The early 20th century home was in shambles, abandoned for years after it was cut up and used as a makeshift apartment building.
It was still really chopped up and dark because all the windows were boarded up, but I liked just the space.
Not long after, Austin bought it, and he did it for a few reasons. First, it had a significant discount. The nonprofit running the St. Clair Place housing project reserved the offer for people making 80% of the area's median income. Second, the same group would oversee its renovation. It was outfitted with a new, spacious layout with modern appliances and utilities.
It's got a double staircase, which we think was original. It's hard to tell, but they kept it because...
But the third reason, maybe the most important for Austin, he trusted the people doing it. Near East Area Renewal, or NEAR, started the St. Clair Place project 7 years ago, when more than 43% of the neighborhood was vacant or abandoned. NEAR turns the lots into affordable housing, some rentals, some to own. It recently finished its 100th home. NEAR director John Franklin Hay is a longtime St. Clair Place resident.
I love this place. It's feisty. It's half crazy. It's wonderful. It's inviting. It's alive.
Today, the neighborhood is a blend of renovated homes and longtime residents. But in the project's early days, Hay says some residents were skeptical.
My first meeting with the St. Clair Place Neighborhood Association, I think, if I could have gotten tarred and feathered and run out of town, it would have been possible, and I hadn't even done anything.
Hay says one plan, to tear down an especially old home to make room for a pocket park, was panned by residents. The community told NEAR the home had meaning to them, and Hay says he learned to listen.
Within 3 months, I felt like I could walk on water.
Hay says the project has displaced no one, since every lot NEAR works on is abandoned or vacant. This is intentional. The project is designed to avoid gentrification, when massive amounts of money are dumped into an area, raising property values and forcing longtime residents out. When you buy a home from NEAR, you sign a contract. For the first 5 years you live there, if you sell and make a profit, you have to give that amount back. This is meant to deter investors looking for a quick profit. After those 5 years are up, though, low to moderate income residents suddenly have the opportunity to build wealth.
We've gone 50 years in some neighborhoods where long-term residents have really been prevented from building wealth, and home ownership is one of the only ways that, frankly, you and I and others will ever be able to build any sort of wealth.
That's Jeff Bennett, Deputy Mayor of Community Development for the city. The city worked closely with NEAR to secure funding, mostly from federal programs. Bennett applauds the project's success, but says a long-term challenge remains. What if the market takes over and too many people sell when their contract ends?
We can't simply develop neighborhoods that become these market rate enclaves that price people out.
NEAR's answer, as long as federal funding allows it, the plan is to stay one step ahead, to build new affordable homes at the same rate the others are selling. Another potential solution, and the ultimate goal of NEAR's community-based philosophy, is to make a neighborhood so nice people just want to stay. For resident Andy Austin, whose contract has ended, it's working.
I enjoy Sunday morning sitting on my front porch, and all the really early risers are out jogging, and then the people walking the dogs, and then the people walking the kids, and we still have issues, but it feels like a neighborhood now.
For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Drew Dodlin.
I think that my role is to be accessible to the public, to listen to their concerns, be there for the officers and also the employees of the Valparaiso Police Department.
That is the new Valparaiso Police Department Chief, Jeff Ballin, during a recent conversation here on Regionally Speaking.
I feel that it's important that the police department and the community work together, and that's one of my responsibilities, is to facilitate that cooperation.
If you will, give us a brief look at your career. What's gotten you to this point is now the head of the department.
I've been at Valparaiso Police Department for a little over 25 years now. I started out in the patrol division where I was promoted to corporal and eventually sergeant in 2004 when Chief Brickner took over the helm. Under Mayor Costas, I was laterally transferred into the Detective Division. At that point, I've been there for numerous years. Eventually, one of my duties was being a member of the Northwest Indiana Major Crimes Task Force. Eventually, I was appointed as the assistant commander of that task force, where we worked many homicides and other type of high-profile investigations. Mm-hmm. I was there for a few years, and then in 2015, I was appointed as the captain of investigations by Chief Brickner, which led me to this appointment by Mayor Costas when Chief Brickner retired.
Mm-hmm. Since you've had a chance to deal with high-profile crimes, you can certainly, I'm sure, have to include this in your total assessment of crimes in the city of Valparaiso. What do you see as the situation right now? We don't. There are a lot of crimes that probably go on that people are not aware of. There are also the high-profile things like the opioid crisis that lead to addictions and crimes that are related to that, too.
That is true. I think that is one of the driving factors for crime in Valpo. We're in a relatively safe community, and I believe, though, one of the factors for crime is the drug addictions. Mm-hmm.
You've had a chance to, over your 25 years with the police department to see the issue grow, unfortunately, and it's unfortunately grown seemingly out of control. When you started as a patrol officer with the Valparaiso Police Department, what incidents did you come across in your work on the street that gave you this clue that the problem with drugs, not only the opioids, but any substance abuse for that matter, what did you see the problem start to be a problem not only for the police, but for the community as well?
Well, that probably started early on in my career, just when you as a patrol officer, a lot of your calls for service deals with theft reports, burglar reports, DUI enforcement, OWI enforcement, things like that. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times when you do come across the persons responsible, oftentimes they're willing to identify a reason for what they were doing. And a lot of times that was because of addiction issues.
So maybe even some cases you talk to people, not only people involved in victims of crimes for that matter, but people involved in crimes too, and you can probably tell for some cases they're high on something, I would imagine.
Well, we always want to find out why someone did what they did, and I think with any avenue, there's, conversation needs to take place, and that's with victims, that's with our persons responsible for it. So, we always want to know why someone did what they did, just so we could help address problems in the future.
Now, besides the issue of drug abuse and addiction and the like and the crimes that come about from those types of incidents, what else do you see as the typical crime in the city of Valparaiso these days?
You have a lot, probably thefts. There's some burglaries. That's probably the majority of the type of crime that we do get.
Your time as a patrol officer and then as a detective with the Valparaiso Police Department had to give you a chance to check out some unusual, some high-profile crimes, some very dramatic crimes. I know it's not been all that many years ago that in the city of Valparaiso there was a hostage-taking incident that tied up police resources for quite a while until it was finally resolved. If you will, recall that for us and tell us how you helped with your colleagues there on the police department to basically resolve the problem.
Well, sure. I was part of the team that negotiated the release of those individuals that were taken hostage. Mm-hmm. So, but there were many people involved. The officers that initially responded, the SWAT team members, there were federal and local and state authorities that assisted with that.
Now, in your estimation, taking a look now at that crime that happened, how do you think the things resolved pretty much? Certainly to success, no one was seriously hurt or hurt, and the thing was resolved successfully. And you think that's the way that things have worked out well, and that's the way you kind of follow through to help keep the streets of Valparaiso safe?
Well, I think it's a group effort. I don't think that one particular individual can do everything, and I think it's important to have a team philosophy, a team concept that has things come together, hopefully so we can have good resolutions.
We're talking with Valparaiso Police Chief Jeff Ballin. He's been appointed by Mayor John Costas to take the position as the head of the department. Michael Brickner left to take a position in Porter County government. You're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. And from time to time, we've had conversations talking about Art House, a Social Kitchen. Well, that's the full title of the facility that is now across the street from the baseball diamond, if you're not familiar with it, is in downtown Gary. And in our conversations, we've talked about different aspects of the Art House project, how it got started and the like. And we have with us in the studio one of the people who's been instrumental in getting this entire project, and many of the others that have in turn over the years have had recent support from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation to talk about this. Gary Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson, the studio. Mrs. Mayor, thank you for being by.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris. It's great to be here.
This is always such an interesting project to talk about it because it spans all kinds of disciplines. It spans business, it spans culinary interests, it spans arts, and it's all come together very nicely as the vision of one person brought this up years ago, Theaster Gates, and his work and with his staff members and others working on this particular project. How important has Art House itself, and for that matter, all of the other projects, and by those kind of starting out with Art House, since that was the first of the series of projects, but going on with such things as now is Steel City Salvage, which is doing very well.
Absolutely.
And of course, and the one that's coming up now, which is going to be worked on, which is converting what seems to be a dilapidated church in downtown Gary into something of interest. How are all these projects that are together being supported by the Knight Foundation so important to the health and well-being of the city of Gary?
Well, it's important in a number of ways. And I have to tell you that the Art House concept didn't come from Theaster. He certainly jumped in. Mm-hmm. But it came from the fact that Bloomberg was doing a public art challenge. And they were doing it nationwide, and they were willing to give $1 million. And I said, that's good, but we need that public art to do something in service of the community.
Right.
And at the same time, we were talking to the Knight Foundation, and the Legacy Foundation had been so supportive. We were talking to Theaster and his team about how could we do this. And then the University of Chicago was involved, of course, with our own local folk. And so we said, why not have public art that really lives on? It's not just a one-and-done project. It's something that serves the community continuously. Mm-hmm. And that's where the culinary incubator came in. And so the Knight Foundation was so excited about the aspect of having a culinary incubator, an opportunity to really drive one of the issues that we thought was a problem in the city, not having enough restaurants. And so this has been just a tremendous project because we've seen people who may not have had their dreams invested in, who may not have had an opportunity to pursue their ideas. And, you know, there are many people who think, you know, I have a talent in this area. I have a talent in food. I want to be involved. But through the help of the through the Knight Foundation,
right,
we've been able to really allow them to pursue that. And, of course, this is the first anniversary of Art House, and this weekend there will be a public competition, and I'm going to be one of the judges. I'm one of the lucky judges to see if someone who does baked goods, to see who comes out on top, and that person will have an opportunity to provide their goods to Majestic. And we know they have a lot of traffic coming through every day. Mm-hmm. So that's a tremendous opportunity for them.
What a great opportunity to bring not only the people interested in creating businesses, culinary businesses in
sure.
this case in particular, but tying them together with whatever results from the competition, turning into basically an actual contract for services for
it's
the
casino.
It's
sort of like our own Shark Tank of sorts.
It's
and we're excited about that. But we're also very area, and you alluded to it earlier. So Steel City Salvage is a business that doesn't just get involved in the demolition side, but they are involved in the deconstruction side. We know that many of these homes have material that you will never find in a home again. I mean, marble, so much decorative wood, so many unique types of forms of tile. We are getting that, getting those items, and we're able to bring them together and resell them as a benefit to the city. And so as people go through, you know, built-in cabinets, other things that are in these houses that cannot be reused, but we can certainly reuse some of the materials. And that's what's happening. In fact, yesterday I went to an event, and a caterer had used a decorative door from a bookshelf, a built-in bookshelf, to display food. And, you know, folks looked at it and they were like, wait a minute, that's not a plate, that's a door. That's a bookcase door. Mm-hmm. And it was a beautiful display. And so that's the type of thing that you would find at Steel City Salvage. And that's been a tremendous night project. And then, you know, my own favorite, I have to tell you, and I love Art House. Mm-hmm. I go there whenever possible just to enjoy, because the work that Theaster has done as the artistic director is just phenomenal. The work he's done with wood and with the different areas, the bar and all of that. But my personal favorite in terms of a night project that has been supported is the turning the City United Methodist Church into a ruined garden.
That's going to be very interesting. And this is the way the concept is, has been envisioned by the people working on the project. It's going to be very, very advantageous for anybody to take advantage of when the weather's going to be nice and warm.
It is.
It's going to be a great place to visit.
I can't wait to walk over there. And the concept came out of Europe. Because there really aren't that many here in the U.S. But the concept came out of Europe, and it's going to use the main sanctuary still. And, you know, many of us remember going to Seaman Hall as a kid. So Seaman Hall will go away, but the main cathedral portion will still be used for community events. It will be in as much intact as we can maintain it, and it will turn that area, because that's the only sort of blemish, if you will, in that area. So mm-hmm. much of the other things have been either demolished or deconstructed or refurbished. You've got a school across the street from there, and we're going to transform that area, the last thing in that area, quite frankly, into something that will be a community asset. We're excited about it.
That's great. I guess now we can look ahead now. I'm sure there'll be more projects that in future years here, and even this next year, when it's time once again to put in something into the city's challenge for the grant from the Knight Foundation.
Well, you
something
know,
else
we've
to
been
think of
very,
too.
We've been very fortunate mm-hmm. that we, of the last 3 years, of the last 4 years, we've gotten three projects approved. And in fact, Art House was the largest single grant made during that time. Mm-hmm. So we've been very fortunate, and I think we've made great use of it. The Knight Foundation has agreed. The Bloomberg Foundation has agreed. And so we're excited about this Saturday and excited about the next time they offer the challenge.
That's great. Well, we'll look forward to for whenever they put the call out for projects and see what happens here from the City of Gary. No doubt there'll be another one that's going to be just as interesting, too.
Yes, sir.
Gary Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson with us here in the studio to talk about the impact that Art House, the Social Kitchen, and all of the projects that have been put up as successful ones by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation and the Bloomberg Foundation,
yes,
supporting these projects in the City of Gary. Madam Mayor, thank you for coming in to talk about it today.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Indiana's received a chunk of the money coming in from the settlement for the Volkswagen problems with the emissions controls on vehicles that they had. And a lot of other states were able to take advantage of this Environmental Mitigation Trust Fund. But Indiana's doing pretty well. And to find out where the funds are going to go here in the Hoosier State, let's call on South Shore Clean Cities Executive Carl Lissick to talk about it. Carl, thanks for being with us.
It's always a pleasure to be with you, Chris. Thank you very much for having us.
Now, first, tell us a little bit about the problems that Volkswagen managed to get themselves into that in turn led to the litigation and now the settlement, and how Indiana is going to be able to take advantage of the share of the settlement monies that they're getting.
Sure. Basically, Volkswagen Corporation, VW, and its subsidiaries, they basically had a mission testing defeat devices called. And over 500,000 vehicles across the United States were sold and operated back in the U.S. from 2009. So U.S. EPA has negotiated a settlement with VW, and they're calling it the Partial Settlement Consent Decree. And the settlement would require VW Volkswagen to pay about $2.7 billion into this Environmental Mitigation Trust Fund. And so it will offset the excess air pollution emitted by some of these vehicles that Volkswagen had produced that violated what's called the Clean Air Act throughout the United States. So the portion of our state expects to get about $40.9 million from the trust. And this money will be paid over a 3 to 10 year period. So right now, Chris, what we're trying to do is working with the Indiana Department of Environmental Management and all of our partners, not only here in Northern Indiana, but across the state, is looking at opportunities how we can potentially leverage this money and help with the cleanup of a dirty diesel, and what this is specific to is nitrous oxides, and look at programs and plans that is going to help us reduce diesel emissions across the state of Indiana.
Well, it's interesting that the state of Indiana should be able to use this fund that's come about because of the settlement here over the faulty VW diesel vehicles and turn it into something to help clean up our air from our own vehicles that we have here in the Hoosier State.
Absolutely. And, it is exciting. I mean, this is really, we've been working diligently with other state partners, here in Northwest Indiana, just looking at ways of reducing not only diesel emissions, but vehicle emissions in general. And this program potentially would help us alleviate, some of those emission requirements. And collectively, working with just a whole slew of partners, looking at opportunities that are going to create economic development, that are going to create jobs, that are going to create just things that are going to help with, like I said, diesel emissions here in Lake Porter and LaPorte County. So we're really excited about just this opportunity to work with partners. We're excited about, because this is going to affect not only nonprofits, governmental entities, but it's also going to affect working with private business owners. So anybody that drives a diesel vehicle has the opportunity to really be part of a plan here in Northwest Indiana that's going to help not only potentially replace some of these dirty diesel vehicles, but it's also going to do it at a very rewarding potential price. And so right now what the state is doing, Chris, is the state is beginning to take public comments in regards to how this money potentially could be spent throughout our state. And so there's a variety of categories that we're working on. So let me just highlight some of those categories.
Yeah.
So over-the-road trucks like Class A trucks and port trucks, school buses, shuttle buses, transit buses, local freight trucks, locomotives, what are called diesel switcher locomotives. Money's also going to be available for upgrade of eligible diesel-powered ships and tugboats in and around Lake Michigan. There'll be partnerships for our airports for replacing eligible diesel-powered airport ground support equipment. This will also be available for eligible forklifts and different types of handling equipment in industry. And then it's also going to potentially for light-duty, zero-emission vehicles and charging stations here in and around Indiana. So we anticipate that the state will be an all-inclusive, that they're looking at ways that this is going to help not just in Northwest Indiana but across the state. And so currently what we're hoping to do is between now and probably the spring of 2018, assist the state in hosting a variety of public meetings where they can garner public input on how this money potentially should be spent. And what we're trying to do is work with all the different partnerships that we have to put a plan together that would be not only assist these organizations, but help assist diesel emissions here in Lake Porter and LaPorte counties.
Do you think that with this plan in place here in Northwest Indiana, it not only will make it easier to be able to take advantage of the settlement funds that the state is getting and can divvy out to Northwest Indiana, as well as helping the businesses, the non-governmental entities, governmental agencies, whoever that happens to have equipment that runs on diesel, to be able to replace the dirty diesel with a cleaner MUFA?
I totally believe that. And again, working with our local metropolitan planning organizations like NERPC and MACOG, the Michigan Area Council of Governments, we've been doing a variety of education events to introduce people to different alternative fuel vehicles, to different clean diesel types of activities. And unfortunately, what happens a lot of times, Chris, is a lot of private industry does not know that they can take advantage of some of these activities. And that's really our goal, is how we can collectively work together between government, nonprofits, and for-profit industries to really have a very good plan put together for Northwest Indiana. And that's really what we hope our role to be, is that we can be a facilitator of some of these different projects, and look at ways that we can leverage other funding to just clean up our air here in Northwest Indiana.
That's Carl Lissick, who is the executive director of South Shore Clean Cities, talking about the Volkswagen settlement funds coming from Volkswagen America into Indiana, and how that is being allocated and worked through South Shore Clean Cities as ways to help fund clean diesel programs. Now it's time for Eye on the Arts with John King of South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Tom Roach, who heads the Department of Communications and Creative Arts at Purdue Northwest. I think this is our first visit together, Tom, isn't it?
It is. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I'm glad to have you. I know that Purdue has always been associated more with sciences and engineering,
yes,
and not the arts. However, Purdue Northwest
yeah,
has been establishing itself as a player in the arts for the last number of years now.
Yeah, since Tom Keehan got here as chancellor about 5 years ago, we've broken out of that mold, and we're now trying to position ourselves as more of a metropolitan university where we're offering a full range of classes and college experiences, including sports and theater and art and music and all of that. So we're trying to be the full service university right now.
I know I'm friends with Judy, who has been for many years responsible for putting that fantastic sculpture on the campus in Westville.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And now she's doing that in Hammond as well.
Yeah, I think Judy was the best part of the merger, because she had all of this artwork that was in storage, and it just flooded onto the Hammond campus, and we're a much more beautiful site right now because of that. Yeah,
yeah, that's great. She, I've known her for almost 20 years, I would say, and she's on our Regional Arts Council. It's great to have, and it's great to have somebody from Purdue involved in that way.
Sure.
Trish Hales has long been on.
Of course, yeah. Trish is in my department.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay, one of the things that you have going on is an art gallery, a standalone gallery on Kennedy Avenue.
Yes.
Let's talk about that a little bit.
Sure. It's called the Chess Gallery, and that's because our college at Purdue Northwest is the College of Humanities and Social Education and Social Sciences, and so, you know, that's our acronym.
Mm-hmm.
Gallery's been there going on 2 years, and we're doing shows of student work, also faculty shows, and we're also taking submissions from people in the community as well, and we're hoping to do a high school student show sometime after January 1st.
Mm-hmm. It's a handsome gallery. It's a handsome space.
It is, isn't it? It's just all glass at the front, and it filters through, and we've really enjoyed it. Yeah.
Yeah. And the other gallery that's next door has multiple tenants, I believe.
Well,
I can't think of.
Yeah, Jocelyn Galagas set up a gallery next door, and then once we moved in and put our gallery in, she turned that space over to someone who's running. It started out as a coffee shop. I'm not sure what it is right now, but it's a small little restaurant gathering place, and it's been very popular.
It gives people more to do, though.
Yeah.
In that area. So you yourself, you're a photographer.
Yes. You know, my uncle told me once I was going to be a jack of all trades and master of none. And so I paint and do photography, but, you know, I'm not the expert on those things.
Have you been at Purdue Northwest for a long time?
Yeah, I think it's my 31st year.
Oh, well, that's a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so you've had a career there.
Yes, I did. Yeah, my PhD's in rhetorical theory. Yeah.
Rhetorical theory sounds like something that scares me.
It's kind of scary. It's Aristotle and stuff. But, you know, they didn't hire me to do the art stuff, but, that was sort of always my hobby and my interest throughout my career. Even when I was getting my degrees, I was taking art classes when I could.
So you're over the theater and other all kinds of performing arts.
Yes, yeah. That's all those classes are taught through our department, and we sponsor most of the events. Mm-hmm. English department is also a little bit involved in theater right now, and they're going to be doing more of that. So we're going to have a lot of theater, actually.
And where is it presented?
Well, on the Westfield campus, they're involved with the Michigan City groups, and they do things in Michigan City. I'm not sure what the locations are. I'm not as familiar with that area. Mm-hmm. At the Hammond campus, we're doing our big productions in Alumni Hall, and then we do small productions in the Wygene Theater, which is next to Alumni Hall, and it seats about 75.
Mm-hmm. And you have an art and photography summer class coming up in Paris.
I do. Yeah, I get to go on that one.
This is not a Purdue thing, and I don't associate all of this. This is fantastic.
We've got Purdue has tons of study abroad stuff going on in the summers. This is just one of many. Ours was one of my art teachers set it up, and then decided she didn't want to go. And so I said, "Well, I'm not going to cancel this. I'll take them." And
nice
I went over with four students the first year, and the second year we had 11, and last year we had 10 again.
And that
it's
sounds like
you know we go to the Louvre three times, and you know D'Orsay, and all the great museums, the Picasso Museum, yeah. Orange.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for being here, and please come again to tell us what's going on at the Chess Gallery and elsewhere on campus, both campuses, and good luck with
everything. Yeah, thanks for having me, and I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you, and thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
And John Kane there talking with Tom Roach, who is the director, the chairman of the Department of Communication and Creative Arts at Purdue University Northwest about the PNW's growing arts program. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us. Back with you tomorrow.